I will call the remote hearing of the Environment and Natural Resources Conference Committee to order. Today is May 11th, 2021. This meeting is held in accordance with Rule 10.01, which was passed and allows for remote hearings. All remote hearings are recorded and live streamed by House Public Information. The clerk will take attendance by roll.
Right. Chair Hansen is present. Representative Wasilewicz.
Wasilewicz present.
Representative Morrison.
Morrison present.
Representative Fisher.
Fisher present.
Representative Heintzeman.
Heintzeman present.
Chair Ingebretson.
Chair Ingebretson is present, and we do have a quorum, and that's all. That's really all we need. Thank you.
Senator Rood.
Rood present.
Senator Eichhorn.
Eichhorn present.
Senator Tomassoni. Senator Tomassoni. Senator Westrum. Senator Westrum. And as Chair Ingebretson said, quorum is present. Thank you.
Thank you, members. So today, Senator Ingebretson, not much has changed. We have we do not support a two-year delay in the clean car rulemaking, and since the offer was contingent upon that, I think it's important that we have some members with questions about some items in the bill, and so we'd like to proceed with some of those questions today. I don't think we'll be lasting all morning. I know members have some other items to deal with. It appears that as we're moving towards May 17th, that not much is happening anywhere, not just in this committee, but we will proceed with trying to deal with information and see if we can reach some compromise. So I know Representative Wasilewicz had a question about some differences in our items.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was actually, I know we had a little bit of conversation about this in our committee, but I'm wondering if someone from the DNR could just talk a little bit about the turtle provisions in the omnibus bills. I think I'd like to hear a little bit of background information about sort of how we got here to this point, because I think this is an issue that's been worked on for a couple of years. So if there's someone from DNR who can talk a little bit about that history and how we got to this point and what we're doing with turtle stuff in the bill.
And maybe as DNR is getting ready, I know Senator Ingebretson, I think you raised your hand. Is it still up?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
You got me. Okay. All right. Well, you know, I wouldn't say that we haven't got anywhere. I mean, we certainly haven't got anywhere with any proposals, but we've certainly had a good discussion. We're very familiar with the DNR discussion. So I think what we're going to do is, V and I did not get a decent proposal here. I'm a little concerned that we're getting closer and closer here. I don't know what part the administration's playing in helping you out with this. But Representative Hansen, yesterday you spoke about policy based on the offers we have received. It's apparent that your officers have not been serious considering policy issues you claim that are priorities. Which you've not yet even included in your proposals. I mean, we talked about environmental justice. We talked about several different things yesterday, and I've seen nothing like that in your proposals. So with that, I look forward to seeing a serious offer from the House addressing those very issues and demonstrating good faith negotiations. And with that, Mr. Chair, I see no reason to sit around and discuss, but if you are with the DNR and your members aren't familiar with the bill, you can, you know, certainly go ahead and do that. But at this point in time, I will be leaving the meeting, and my conferees can weigh in on this if they'd like, or they can also stay, whatever they choose to do. But until I get an offer, that's where I'm going to be at. Okay.
Well, Senator Ingebretson, you know, we've already provided two offers in a row. I don't think it's the House's responsibility to keep changing their offers based on your acceptance or whether you think they're serious or not. We provided a serious offer. Every offer we've done has been serious. And we have been trying to achieve at least some common ground on some items. But when it continues to be that the LCCMR should be used for in the budget and that a two-year delay of clean cars, that everything is contingent on that, it's very difficult to do anything. And so we believe there are priorities. We included one yesterday, which was the AIS fee. That was there. You know, a normal process would be, we've provided three offers. I believe you've provided two. It would be your turn to respond, but I'm open to trying to find some other, you know, if that doesn't work, we have some items today we want to talk about that are differences in the bill, and I would ask you to stay, or one of your members or two of your members to stay, because I think we can help problem solve by sharing information on that. There's some provisions you have, and some provisions we have, and some provisions where they're different. So, but I understand if you've got other things to do. Until we're still dealing with the clean car thing, you know, it's hard to move past that. I again would, if we're moving towards May 17th and things are not getting done, I would ask again if you can consider moving the LCCMRs as part of this conference committee. Maybe that's all we can agree on. I think we're probably very close on the 2021 and we're kind of close on the 2020. It would be a shame to dance up to June 30th and find that those don't occur.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Sure. The last offer I got from you was basically, with all due respect, quite meaningless. So the second offer that I got was quite significant. If you're not willing to move on any of those articles or those things that we were talking about, I don't see sitting here and just talking today is going to do any good. Actually, I would suggest that maybe the DNR spend some time with you and go over the bills if you're not familiar with the bills. LCCMR, now you know very well that that's staying in the bill. And you're holding strong on the clean cars, and that's real. You know, that's kind of where we're at. But I have, you know, we can get a lot of other stuff done, but I don't get anything, hardly any proposals of any substance. So I will be waiting, and I will let you know whether or not we're going to call the meeting tomorrow. So,
Senator Ingebrigtsen, I do have one kind of completely different thing, if you're interested.
Sure, of course.
So I think that the timber relief, those contracts for those loggers up north has a deadline. And now we have got federal guidance, you know, from the feds on what they can spend money on. And we would like to prepare, I've been working with Representative Eklund, we would like to prepare a letter to the governor asking, because I think there's an extreme timeliness of trying to provide relief to those loggers. And I would ask you if you are willing to, you know, this isn't passing legislation, but if we could jointly do a letter to the governor on timber relief, you know, that would take it out of our budget hands. But I think it's clearly legitimate for the federal money, and it would be timely for those loggers up north. So I would ask you if you'd like to consider working on that today, because I think timeliness for those folks up in the logging industry is somewhat needed. I mean, I think there's a timely issue there, and I would like to work with you on that if you are willing.
Yes, I am willing to do that. I'd like to see it in written form, Mr. Chair, and we'll decide then. Go ahead and send it over to me when you're done. But you're right. However, it is a very large financial issue in the bill. As you know, we're not going to talk about that until I get my targets. Now, we've got all kinds of indication from the federal government that we're all going to be receiving money to disperse yesterday, but still has not trickled down to the targets. So as far as making any decisions, no. But requesting from the governor, I'd be more than happy to look at that.
Okay.
All right.
We'll go back to Representative Wasalek. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see Assistant Commissioner Meyer has popped up. If he can just talk a little bit about how we got here, and then if it makes more sense for our research staff to go through the differences between the turtle provisions in the House bill and the Senate bill, I think that would be helpful too.
Maybe if Ms. Taylor could just walk through those sections, and then Commissioner Meyer could respond. Ms. Taylor?
Mr. Chair and members, there are a number of different turtle provisions. The first one is on R51. There's also only Section 78 that removes the turtle seller's license. Or wait, no, I'm sorry. There's one before that.
And I just want to thank Ms. Taylor for all of her work while she's patiently going through the side-by-sides. And you know, Mr. Stanley. So, Ms. Taylor.
I'm going to skip that one for now so you don't have to wait for me. But this particular one that I was mentioning is, this is the one that would prohibit the sale of turtles and also require a recreational turtle license. And then there is a Senate-only section on the bottom of that page, Section 78. I don't know if Mr. Stanley is still here or if he left with the Senate, but this particular one would remove the prohibition on transferring only once the turtle seller's license.
Mr. Stanley? Proceed, Ms. Taylor.
Okay. Section 79 and R52, this section would make some conforming changes to the removal of the turtle seller's license, and then also sort of expand some of the exemptions from the turtle seller's license, for example, adding aquatic farm licensees. Section 79 and 80 on the bottom of R52, the Senate is taking, I think this was a DNR proposal to add to the list of things you can't do in order to take turtles, and the Senate is taking their provision as it was introduced, adding firearms and ammunition, bow and arrow, spears and harpoons. The House has the spears and harpoons, and then also make some changes related to the removal of the turtle seller's licenses. And then on R53, Section 80 and 81, these are mostly the same. These are putting limits on the number of turtles you can possess based on different species. The only difference is the House has some language getting stricken because of the removal of the turtle seller's license. And then I think there's some repealers that are related to the House provision, and then there's also a prohibition on any additional transfers later on in the bill. I don't know if you want me to find that. And then there's one other section where the turtle seller's license fee and the apprentice fee is removed as well. And I can look through that. But if you guys want to discuss with the DNR as I kind of look through, find those page numbers.
And, you know, maybe Senator Rood, I think it went through their policy committee over there. Maybe she could help out. Senator Rood there. Senator Rood. Senator Rood. Doesn't appear she's there. Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you for the record. Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. And thank you for letting me talk a little bit about this important issue, as we've talked about in committee. Ms. Taylor talked about the differences in the bill. The major one of concern is the Senate position that would remove the sunset provision on turtle licenses, allowing them to be transferred to continue. Mr. Chairman, if you don't mind, I have a few slides I would like to show, if possible. Would that be okay?
That would be awesome. I think anything we can do to help enlighten the conversation so we're familiar with the terms, and I think it's important for Minnesotans to see what we're talking about. Is that okay, Representative Woodslawick? It helps answer questions. So, Commissioner Meyer.
Now I just have to figure out how to do it, so give me a second here. I think you should be able to see my screen now. I just want to talk a little bit about some dynamics in the population dynamics. As we know, turtles are long-lived. They have a very delayed sexual maturity, 10-plus years for many species. High nest predation, as you can see, raccoons, foxes, things like that, other birds. Low hatchling and juvenile survival rates. High annual survivorship of adults due to few natural enemies. And adult turtles are most important age class for the most important age class for population stability and persistence, especially in females. We talked about this slide a little bit, but this just shows a reproductive potential of snapping turtle versus big game species and how long it takes for one turtle, 17 years for a snapping turtle to be sexual maturity, whereby a deer at that point in time would have had 912 offspring. So they're very delayed in sexual maturity and other things. This slide, I think, really shows it all. 34 states are closed to commercial harvest currently. 14 states have eliminated turtle harvesting in the last 12 years. And many more states have tightened their regulations. You can see Minnesota here. We're leading the nation on this issue with other friends such as Arkansas, Alabama, places like that. And we have concerns about what that's doing. The growing international demand in the turtle trade is what's driving this increase. Human consumption of snapping turtles and soft-shell turtles are local food sources for some Minnesota residents. They're a national food source at Asian seafood markets in the U.S. and an international food source for Asian markets. Midwest are favored, you know, just like everything from the Midwest is great. I guess our turtles are considered delicacies as well. The pet industry, small painted turtles are very popular. Chinese medicinal purposes and beauty products. Collagen is an example of what people are using them for in some markets. And now U.S. turtles are fueling the Asian market. Since there is an Asian turtle crisis, they've exploited their populations, and they're looking for other areas of the state. Over a period of 2002 to 2012, 126 million turtles were exported from the United States. And in 2016, the United States added four freshwater, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, added four freshwater turtles to the Appendix 3 of Species of Concern, Common Snapping Turtle, Florida Softshell Turtle, Smooth Softshell Turtle, and Spiny Softshell Turtle. Back in 2001 to 2004, the department began work on this important issue, which led to the statutes that we have today, bringing a phased out. We talked about, and we worked and compromised in our initial stance to eliminate turtle harvest. At that point, the recommendation was to specifically eliminate the turtle harvest. Instead, we agreed to a phased kind of elimination of turtle licenses. The proposal specified what species could be harvested commercially, established seasons and size limits, revised trap limits, checking and designing specifications, increased fee for seller's license with a sunset clause. I think that's the most important thing within our proposal at that point in time, was to gradually phase these out, as they couldn't be transferred to on the open market, so to speak. They could only be transferred to a degree of kindred, your grandchildren, one of your relatives. Added monthly reporting requirements. We have, of course, had to deal with the all-important turtle races in Midwestern Minnesota and other resort communities, which I think is important to remember that this is part of our heritage, and we have to figure out how to deal with that issue. and also established guidelines for possessing turtle eggs, protections of turtle nests, and propagation. Mr. Chairman, the commercial harvest right now allows for three species of turtles: painted turtle, the common snapping turtle, and the spiny softshell turtle. We feel at a very minimum, it's important to stop all harvesting, commercial and residential, of spiny softshell turtles. We do not know, we don't have the population demographics available to tell where this species is at, but we're greatly concerned that it's in a decline, and allowing continued harvest is really problematic. So we have a prohibition on any harvest or capture of spiny softshell turtles that is in the Senate bill, or in the House bill, and we're working with the Senate on that position, and also our taking methods. You can see that language is similar on both sides. The real concern was an amendment that was added on the Senate floor that focused on the extension and the transfer of those licenses. Just our concerns with the current turtle harvest regulations. The landscape has changed dramatically since 2003, 2004, when these current harvest regulations were enacted. We feel this harvest is unsustainable due to the life history and cumulative impacts on survivorship. The increase in market demand for turtles, especially the Midwest varieties, are concerns of ours. And also the tightening of regulations in other states has put more pressure on Minnesota turtles. With that, Mr. Chairman, you have seen in our letters, we do support the House position, and we are concerned with the addition of the language in the Senate to remove the sunset provision. May I just add one thing, Mr. Chairman, if you don't mind? In my conversations with former Senate Environment Chair Bob Lazard, who was the chairman during this issue, he strongly supports the prohibition and the elimination of commercial turtle harvesting in the state, and actually was kidding me that there's finally something that he agrees with the DNR on, but he and I have that kind of relationship. But he does recognize, back when this was discussed in the early 2000s, how important of an issue it is, and also supports the House position. I can stand for questions, Mr. Chair.
Just to clarify, former Senator Bob Lazard supports the House position. Is that correct?
Protecting turtles, Mr. Chairman, yes.
Representative Woodslawick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Meyer. That was really helpful in understanding sort of where we've been and where we are now. And I don't know if this is something that you could maybe address too, but I think one of the things we think about is that graphic with the deer and how many baby deer a deer can have in a certain amount of time versus the turtle. But I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about the importance of turtles. So, you know, I don't know, that's sort of a broad question, but sort of why the concern about turtles and sort of where they fit in terms of environment and the our wildlife in Minnesota, and why it's important to protect them.
Commissioner Meyer. Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, sorry, when I pulled up my screen, I couldn't find the unmute button. So I was bringing up that slide again that Vice Chair Woodslawick was looking for. Turtles are a bellwether species. The importance of turtles in the landscape really shows the health of that ecosystem. And that's really important to us. As we know, making sure that we can see and maintain our ecosystems is vitally important just to the success of the species. So where turtle populations are successful, we know we have clean water, abundance of food sources, and those habitats are, I don't want to say pure, but healthy enough to sustain viable populations. I think that's one of the most important things. The canary in the coal mine perspective, and that example of the good, healthy environments. They're also, I think they're importance to tribal nations within the state. They have a tribal cultural significance to some tribes. And a lot of people just associate them with peaceful, you know, environments and serenity, I'll call it, in outdoors. So I know those aren't scientific values, but I think they're, especially nowadays, they're really important to people just to have that opportunity to kind of relax and enjoy nature as well. So I hope that helps answer your question.
Representative Hoswick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, that does help. I think that's an important, the canary in the coal mine piece is important because we want to ensure, I mean, right, the whole goal of having an Environment and Natural Resources Committee to work on these issues is to ensure that we have a healthy environment and clean water and whatnot across the state. So I appreciate the comments there, and I don't have anything else, Mr. Chair, unless other members have questions.
Commissioner Meyer, I have a couple questions on the public resource. So the turtles are part of the public resource. I think most folks are familiar with, you know, the devastation caused by commercial hunting of bison a century and a half ago. And if we go back to the turn of the 20th century, in the 19th century, we had the Migratory Bird Acts that were part of the conservation history and legacy of preventing the commercial harvest of birds for their plumage. And as we moved into the 30s, the actual establishment of seasons, you know, for things because we had for private hunting rather than commercial hunting, you know, and it seems like an anachronism that we have a commercial harvest of turtles, a private profit of, for in 2021, that we have private profit from a public resource like this. And it appears that, you know, in 20 years ago, there was a deal made, and that was to phase things out. But the Senate position is essentially to open things back up. That if the licenses were saleable beyond family members, then anyone could buy them. There'd be so how much profit are we talking about here? What are could the international market purchase a license under the Senate provision and open up you know, a significant harvest again of a public resource? Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, members, again, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, DNR. The licenses have to be held by residents. We don't have any non-resident commercial harvesting licenses. However, those markets, as you mentioned, are what's driving it. The international market trade on these turtle species, because other places have depopulated. They've over-harvested their population, so then obviously you go someplace else. So I think that's one of the biggest drivers that are out there. Now, some of these animals or these amphibians are used for scientific purposes or educational purposes. I think we could find some other species to substitute for that easily. So we were very concerned about that. And it's, you know, the question was that Representative Wozniak had, well, why do we want to keep them? And I think if you go back to some of our great conservation leaders, Aldo Leopold, for example, says the first rule of intelligent thinking or tinkering is to keep all of the parts, right? So obviously we want to keep our turtles around. If we lose an important part of our ecosystem, we risk entire collapse of that ecosystem. So we feel it's important at a very minimum to prohibit the harvesting of softshell turtles, but we do support and would like to see the elimination of the commercial turtle harvest as well. So.
And Commissioner Meyer, as the turtle harvesting equipment has become more effective, is there any way to determine perhaps if endangered turtles are caught in the bycatch, for example, a Blandings turtle? Is there overlapping habitats where we could be losing unique turtles that we just don't know of? I mean, there's not a way to check that, is there?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Bob Meyer again. No, we do require reporting, but sometimes that reporting is lacking, right? We don't have all the information we need, but that is an important consideration is bycatch. And I'd just like to go back to the other statement I made previously is as those other markets or as the opportunity for harvesting in other states decreases, it places increased pressure on the state of Minnesota's resources. So the supply and demand principles are really leading, could cause population decline severely within the state. So We have issues with reporting as well, making sure that people are submitting reports on time and that we're getting the data that we need. So all just other examples of why it's so important to try to do something about this now with the House position, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, members. Any other questions on turtles? Representative Fisher.
Sorry, it wasn't questions on turtles. It was questions on another issue.
Members, anything else on turtles? Okay. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the opportunity. This will be a question for the DNR, and this has to do with the change of making gar a game fish instead of a rough fish. Currently, it is a rough fish, and this also is a very long-lived fish, and I know that there has been some issues around the way that it's being caught and just cast aside, and so I'd like to hear from the DNR what the changes are and protections that come in as we change a proposed classification from rough fish to game fish.
Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, members, again, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. Thank you, Representative Fisher, for that question. Gar is an interesting question. We've been discussing removing gar and bowfin, actually, from the commercial list for a little while now. The primary reason is that they're potential predators on young invasive carp and can tolerate low oxygen conditions where these young invasive carp live. Now, that being said, we don't have a lot of information about the population dynamics. We've considered this as well as other changes to our fish classifications, and we're in the process of taking a deeper dive on what should these classifications be. Currently, they're classified as a commercial fish, which would allow them to be harvested in a bycatch of commercial netting for invasive or rough fish within the Minnesota and the Mississippi rivers. The bow fishing community is also very interested in this population as well. And in a recent large tournament where we monitored Mississippi River Pool 2, gar were the most common fish taken. Now, this was two summers ago, though. We know very little about the gar. As you said, they're very long-lived fish. They're a very small component of the commercial fish habit or commercial fish harvest. But we are concerned about the over harvesting during some of these bow fishing events. And actually, Mr. Chairman, that's what led us to a proposal within our policy provisions. Actually, it's a budget initiative that would allow us to permit and regulate, these bow fishing tournaments so that we could provide conditions and species and things like that, requirements on those tournaments. So, Mr. Chairman, members, let me just see here for people who may not be familiar with what we're talking about. Again, let me just see if I get this right this time. So here's a picture of common gar. If you haven't seen them, they have a long snout, I'll call it, if that's a fishery biology term, probably not. And you can see it has teeth in there as well. So it's a very unique fish. One, we don't have a lot of these type of fish species in Minnesota, but I think it's important, as we talked about, keeping the pieces and not tinkering, Alvo Leopold's statements. This could be a consideration to protect it as a game fish. At a minimum, we are very interested in removing it from the commercial fish harvesting list as well, which we can do administratively, and we're looking into that right now. But we do appreciate the interest in protecting this fish population and want to work with the conference committee in doing so, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Assistant Commissioner Meyer. Appreciate the understanding of it. Sounds like that this is, as you're highlighting, is that these particularly this species is a part of the system, and it can help protect with some of the issues that we have around the invasive carp, et cetera. And if we were to continue to lose the species, and as you mentioned, you've got bow hunters that are out there, that can particularly with the long-lived fish, it could cause the system collapse, and something that could control an invasive would then be missing. So I think it's very important. I appreciate that further understanding. That's something I did not pick up the first time around when I heard it. So I appreciate you spending a little bit more time and further educating us on the subject.
Commissioner Meyer, so if it became a game fish, what would be the process for the DNR on setting limits?
Mr. Chairman, members, again, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner of DNR, we would go through it and through our rulemaking process establish conditions and limits and things like that. We have authority within statute to establish those seasons and methods of take within that emergency rulemaking authority. So every year we would do a rule, or we do rules on some of these things, and that would be one way to do it. Otherwise, we could also come back and work with the legislature and put it in statute. The previous policy provisions of doing it on an annual basis allows us more flexibility to deal with changes in real time. No offense, rather than to come back to the legislature, which, as we know, it takes some time as we're facing right now. So the rulemaking process can be quick for our expedited emergency rules for game and fish, but also it does have a longer process, as we've discussed as well. So, and just to put a plug in, we have concerns about some of the rulemaking processes in the bill as well that we've testified to and is in our letter on other issues. But I digress, Mr. Chairman. I apologize.
Commissioner Meyer, I think you were addressing that rulemaking could be more inclusive, more timely, more deliberative, and more effective than the legislative process, particularly a legislative process that holds rulemaking hostage. Representative Fish, Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to move on to a different subject if you wanted to continue with the garfish, which I find fascinating.
Representative Fisher, were you done?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I was done. Thank you.
Representative Morrison.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to say that I appreciate your continuing with this conference committee. I have to say I'm disappointed that our Senate counterparts departed the meeting. I think the point of conference committee is to have transparency and have the public be able to take in the negotiations and learn about some of the issues that we are debating. So I appreciate the conversation, and there are many more important issues that are left to discuss. Boy, I wish they'd stayed so that we could work on this together. You know, Assistant Commissioner Meyer was talking about collapse of ecosystems, and we have some real threats in our state right now, one of which is chronic wasting disease. And I hate to burden Ms. Taylor again, but I'm hoping she might walk us through the differences in the Senate and House positions on addressing chronic wasting disease.
Ms. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members, the chronic wasting disease stuff, there's one section that's in Article 5 on the House side, which would be on R42. This would be from the DNR's policy bill, just expanding the importation ban on cervidae carcasses to all carcasses, not just those hunter harvested. And then the remaining provisions would be in Article 7 on the House side, which starts on R178. I'll just go through the sections if that's what you guys want here. Section 1 would allow licensed hunters to take an escaped farm cervidae and then require them to be tested at the owner's expense for CWD. Section 2 would modify the cervidae fencing requirements so that they would prohibit physical contact between the farm cervidae and free-roaming cervidae. Section 3 would require two or more fences for farmed white-tailed deer. Section 4 would require white-tailed deer to have on their ID tags the owner's contact information. And then moving on to R180, Section 5 would require conservation officers to be included in Board of Animal Health inspections when CWD has been detected. Section 6 would prohibit new white-tailed deer farms or registrations for those. Section 7 would require owners of farms where CWD has been detected to allow inspections, and then also would prohibit them from raising farm cervidae for at least 10 years on the premises. Section 8 would transfer cervidae oversight to the DNR from the Board of Animal Health. It would require the DNR to contract with Board of Animal Health veterinarians rather than having the staff transfer. And then Section 9 is just a reviser's instruction related to the transfer.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much, Ms. Taylor. I'm hoping that one of the commissioners from the DNR might talk a little bit about the threat of chronic wasting disease to Minnesota.
Is Commissioner Stroman on, maybe to just address the threat if she's not, Commissioner Meyer?
Mr. Chairman, members, I know Commissioner Stroman is on. She's been having some challenges with her internet this morning for some reason. So I'm not sure if she can join us or not. I believe she's still having issues. So, Mr. Chairman, I think if you don't mind, I can just jump in. And hopefully if she gets her issues resolved, she could just raise her hand and chime in if that's okay.
Yep. Proceed.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman and House members, for your continued interest in this issue. Our wild deer herd is so important to just Minnesota. As we're talking about turtles as an iconic species, I think the white-tailed deer is much more so in a lot of people's eyes, and the importance that provides to us economically, as over 500,000 hunters every year participate in the annual tradition of being in the woods and deer hunting. As we've recently saw with the new identification of CWD in our herd in Beltrami County, the disease has just traveled over 300 miles through a deer in a horse trailer or however it was brought to the farm. This new infestation changes the world as we know it in deer management and CWD, at least for the DNR, for the next 3 years. As our DNR response or CWD response plan talks about, we presented that to you. I can share with you again. Once a disease is identified in a farm, we have to survey that area, a 15-mile circle surveillance zone, for 3 years and keep our fingers crossed. Hopefully we do not find anything. If we do, then we move into a more persistent type of approach of monitoring, surveillance, and population reduction to avoid that nose-to-nose contact. So what the language that you have in your bill, the fencing piece, I think is extremely important to make sure that nose-to-nose contact doesn't occur. We've seen cases where a deer farm we've inspected has a wild deer path beaten down the side of the fence where these deer are walking next to each other, communicating, exchanging saliva. Some cases there is actually feed thrown through the fence. So another management problem where you're attracting wild deer to be next to these captive wild deer. I mean, that's the problem in general with the farm cervid industry. We don't have another industry in Minnesota where we're raising wild animals and calling it agriculture. Turkeys, cows, things like that, sure, they're an agricultural species, but now wild deer or farm cervid are defined as an agricultural commodity, which really caused us the problem. So anything we can do to reduce that nose-to-nose contact, I think, is extremely important. The identification that you have in Section 4, making sure that it has a phone number or address that enables the reader to readily identify the owner of escaped deer. We've seen deer that we've captured. It might have a tag or a tag hole. We don't know where it comes from. So making sure that you can readily identify that number, 0042, whatever it would be, to so-and-so farm is extremely important. The inspection that language that you have, than allowing the DNR to be included on epidemiological investigations or source and trace outs is extremely important. Our officers are trained investigators, trained interrogators. What we see and the questions we ask sometimes are different than the Board of Animal Health agents, and we learn a lot more. We've found things that have been not identified in other investigations that have been crucial to our investigation and closeout of those investigations and the activities on those farms. So thank you for putting that language into the bill. That is one thing as well that we need to see. The language that you have on mandatory surveillance and the movement, we appreciate as well. The transfers of duties, we've talked about this a little bit. We are willing to accept these activities in this program, but we need to make sure that the resources are provided with it. We do not want to have to spend deer hunters' dollars managing, enforcing, and inspecting farmed wild deer facilities. So the deer hunters shouldn't have to pay for that, and we can work with the committee on what the estimates of those costs would be. At the end of the day, we need to improve our enforcement and inspections and work with this industry to protect the wild deer herd. The DNR stands willing and ready to do that, be it through a transfer of duties to the Board of Animal Health or working with the Board of Animal Health more closely as the language provides for epidemiological inspections and things of that nature. So we want to be a part of the solution. We hope to work with you all to craft a solution that will provide more protections for the state's wild deer herd and also for the captive wild deer herd at these farms. But making sure that we have that ability, authority to be where we need to be, reducing the movement wherever at all possible, and protecting that contact are some of the things that your language does that we fully support. And just thank you for your continued interest. Protecting our wild deer herd as part of our iconic history, but also as a food source for our native populations and tribal nations is extremely important. So we, again, stand ready and willing to do what we can and appreciate the support that you have for these programs in your bill. Mr. Chairman, I'll also note for the record that we are in the process of finalizing the inspections that have occurred up in the Beltrami herd, and we look forward to briefing yourself and Chairman Ingebrigtsen and others on that important situation here in the next coming days. So stay tuned for that information as well.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I see that Commissioner Stroman joined us too. So it's my understanding that CWD is 100% fatal. So we have this, and please confirm if I'm right or wrong on that. But so it seems to me that
Commissioner Meyer, let's get the confirmation. Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Meyer, Department of Natural Resources, Representative Morrison, yes, it is a neurological disease that affects the brain and the spinal. It's contained within the brain and spinal matter of the animals, and it is fatal. It takes some time, unfortunately. You can't detect it right away by physical attributes. And the only way to test for it right now is through testing brain matter from a deceased animal. So, but it is 100% fatal.
Tom Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And another quick question. It's transmitted via saliva. You referred to nose-to-nose contact, Assistant Commissioner.
Commissioner Meyer.
Chairman, again, Bob Meyer, Representative Morrison. Yes, it's body fluids, so it could be saliva. It could be other secretions from body fluids that are there. And as we've talked about in committee, it can be persistent into the soil. The prions, what it actually is, CWD is a mutated protein that then causes all sorts of other problems, as you know from being a medical professional, Representative Morrison, how those things start, right? So it's a mutated protein that becomes into the body of these animals through transfer of bodily fluids that is picked up and then mutated within the body of that animal.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I recall from committee hearings, there's probably concern that remains left in the field could also be a source of transmission if other animals ate remaining entrails.
Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Morrison, yes. In fact, that is the basic premises of of the adopt a dumpster program that is in the House position, and we've supported by the House and Senate last biennium to do that. So we provide dumpsters for hunters to use, dispose those carcasses in before they leave those areas. And it's very important that people realize that you cannot leave the endemic area in the southeast or any other CWD management zone with a deer carcass intact. So you either have to bring it to a processor, take down that, break it into quarters, process your own deer or something. You cannot leave with a deer, what we call in the round or whole, outside of those endemic areas to reduce the transportation of those body tissues contained within the brain and the spinal cord.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Assistant Commissioner Meyer. So I'm going where I'm sure a lot of people are going. Hunters hunt deer to eat deer. So there must be concerns about human consumption of infected meat. I know I wouldn't be excited about feeding my children deer that I knew had CWD prions in it. Where are we with all that? I know that we have this great work from Dr. Larson of the U developing this rapid test. But this strikes me, we're talking about possible ultimate decimation of our white-tailed population and the implications for the people who rely on that meat for food and our proud heritage, hunting heritage in our state.
Commissioner Stroman or Commissioner Meyer?
Mr. Chair, Sarah Stroman, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. I'm going to take a chance on my internet. Can you understand me? Just want to make sure before I... Perfect.
Yes.
Good.
Yes.
I'm having one of those moments where the computer responds about 5 minutes after you hit a button. So, and so I apologize for not popping on earlier and appreciate the discussion, Mr. Chair and Representative Morrison, about chronic wasting disease. This has been a issue of great concern to the department for a number of years now and continues to be one of the things that we want to continue to be proactive on, we want to continue to be aggressive on for all the reasons that you have been discussing. And, the concerns over consumption of deer meat or venison is one of the reasons for that. You know, we have a very robust deer hunting tradition and deer hunting community. In Minnesota, we have about 500,000 deer hunters. And as Assistant Commissioner Meyer mentioned too, that's a very important food source for our tribal communities as well, who view that harvest a little bit differently than some of our other deer hunters, but really important nonetheless. The CDC does recommend that people not consume deer that are infected with chronic wasting disease. I know I have heard from deer hunters concerns over the potential spread to areas where they hunt for that reason, concerns over consuming it. And I think if you look, for example, at Wisconsin, where the disease has gotten sort of beyond what is controllable through management tools, it's fundamentally changed the way deer hunting happens in Wisconsin. It has changed that relationship between hunters and deer. And so I think that's, really our goal here is that we still have an opportunity in Minnesota to contain this disease, to keep it out of parts of the state. And so we feel very strongly that we need to take that opportunity for, the cultural reasons, for the human health reasons, for the benefit of our deer population, and of course, the economic benefits that deer hunting and deer watching bring to communities all across the state.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. So I guess I'm left thinking about the reason we're here, budget negotiations and putting together an environment omnibus bill. What would the implications be for our ability to combat the spread of chronic wasting disease in our state if we don't come to an agreement about funding for some of these programs and projects around CWD?
Commissioner Stroman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morrison, I mean, similar to to the other issues we've discussed, if there isn't a budget, right, there isn't funding allocated to those activities. So, you know, that would severely hamper our ability to address those issues. And I think, you know, the funding is one really important piece here, but I would just remind the committee, I think we've talked about this in the past, that, you know, this is one of those issues where we need the funding, we need the tools to manage through policy, and, you know, we need that research, that important work that the University of Minnesota is doing to help fill those knowledge gaps. And so all of those pieces are really important to Minnesota's success in containing chronic wasting disease. And so, you know, the bill is important for all of those aspects.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, to both you and Assistant Commissioner Meyer for the important work that DNR is doing to try to contain this. It's very frightening.
Commissioner Meyer, I have a question about Section 68 in the House bill, and that is the movement of carcasses. And if my memory serves me correct, in 2020, Senator Ingebrigtsen and Representative Eklund actually authored that provision. It was broadly agreed to about the need. Could you maybe describe the difference between a hunter-harvested deer outside of the state and a hunter-harvested deer within a pen from outside of the state, and what that provision, which I thought was fairly commonly agreed to, meant? Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, members, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner of DNR, and thank you for bringing that up, because I was neglecting bringing that section up in my previous comments. The language that we've been working on that has been there for a while prevents a deer, if I were to go to Colorado on a self-guided or a do-it-yourself hunt for elk or white-tailed deer, muleys, me and a couple of my buddies go up in the mountains, we shoot an animal, we wouldn't be able to bring that carcass back what I call in the round, which was, you know, you would clean the animal. And I'm trying to be as sensitive as I can here with these terms, but you would clean that animal, the harvested animal. And then a lot of people will put them in a trailer or in the back of their pickup truck and drive home. Well, you cannot bring an animal, a cervid harvested outside of the state of Minnesota into the state complete intact like that, because we're concerned of CWD coming in. So what you would need to do would be to quarter it or have it processed locally, bring it back in a freezer or coolers with you, and then the head or the antlers would need to be caped out and then fully clean of all brain matter before it would be allowed back into the state of Minnesota. We have information on our website, YouTube videos on showing people how to do that, remove the horns and clean the skull, or you would just leave that trophy with a local taxidermist in that state where you harvested that animal and have it shipped. The challenge that we ran into with that language is hunter harvested implies that you went and had a license from that state. Now, there are other harvest opportunities where you would go by and pay somebody money to harvest an animal, primarily white-tailed deer, sometimes elk, sometimes exotic game animals, at a game, I'll call it a game farm. These can be pens. Sometimes they're 20 acres. They could be 100 acres, and it could simulate an actual hunt, perhaps. But what you are really doing is paying that landowner or that herd owner the opportunity to harvest one of his animals. And then if you were to bring that back into the state, legally that's not hunting, because you did not buy a license. You took that animal off of a game farm and then bring it into the state. There's still the risk, as much as ever before, of that animal containing CWD. As we know, they can still look healthy and carry the disease with them. So what we're trying to do in that language, which is vitally important, is close this loophole that applies to an average person hunting an animal and another person harvesting an animal. So the real difference is the term harvested, and making sure that we're bringing those animals in without that potentially infected brain matter or spinal matter. So, Mr. Chairman, we do support that language. It's vitally important to get that passed, as well as some of these other pieces, and give us the tools that we need to continue our fight with CWD. I hope that answered your questions, Mr. Chairman.
Yes. Members, any other questions on CWD? Next up, as long as you're here, water export protections. Ms. Taylor, if you could identify the water export protections in the bill. And we're not always aligned on everything with the Department of Natural Resources, but, you know, we can try to be persuasive. So, Ms. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, I think the first sections would be on R64. Well, actually, section 84 is the first one on R64. This states that surface and groundwater are public assets for purposes of water use permitting. That was part of the DNR's water export provision. The Senate has section 87, the House has section 86, expanding a prohibition on issuing water use permits from the Mount Simon Pinckley Aquifer. And then on R64, section 88 and House section 87 are both the same. This is prohibiting new water use permits for bulk transporter. And then the House had also had the public meeting requirement, sections 85. Requiring public meetings before issuing large water use permits.
Commissioner Meyer or Commissioner Stroman, if you may want to describe the provisions that are, I believe, in both same provisions or similar.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Sarah Stroman with the Department of Natural Resources. I'm going to have Assistant Commissioner Meyer described the provisions. He's been working more closely on them, but just to say, you know, we are glad to see this in the bill. We think that this is a really important provision to close some potential gaps that I think we've all become concerned about due to some recent proposals for water transport. So I'll have Assistant Commissioner Meyer go through the provisions, but we appreciate this being in the bill and appreciate the conversation on it today.
Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, members, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. I should just get my shirt that says that so I don't have to say that all the time maybe. But the language on its page R64, Senate Section 88, House Section 87, dealing with the bulk transport or rule that Janelle or Ms. Taylor went through, we appreciate that being on both sides, and that gives us a strong arm to determine when water would be approved to be going out of state and deny when it would be able to go out of state. So we appreciate that being on both sides. The language above that on the House section dealing with public meetings, we understand and fully appreciate the desire of the legislature and of the House in this instance to ensure that the public understands and has a say in these types of issues. And you have us that we would hold a water or a public meeting before issuing a water use permit or plan for consumptive use of more than 216,000 gallons per day in a 30-year period. We'd like to work with you on what that ultimate level or trigger should be for that public meeting at this 216,000 gallons per day. It will pull in more permits than I think that we need to talk about with the public. Dewatering permits, for example, for a construction facility or things like that. So we want to come back and talk to you about that, but we understand the desire and the need there. And we really appreciate the opportunity to give us tools to protect our drinking water or the bulk transfer or sale of our groundwater resources. As we know, water resources are extremely important, and our groundwater is our future, right? It's our living trust for our children's and our children's children to make sure that we have continued groundwater and water resources into the future, which also is why we have some concerns of some of the language on the Senate side that bring us closer to that Western water law mantra, which states that if the water is under your property, it's your water. So we do not want to get into that point. And our letter goes into more detail on those provisions and concerns we have with each one. But I know, Mr. Chairman, your question was about the water transfer language, and we really appreciate that. You know, the language is similar also. There's some language, if you look on page R66, dealing with sustainability standards that we will need to talk about as well, making sure that we understand what the level of recharge means and how that would take place, or the language in the Senate side, which is intended for a stream flow of 20% or less, but it gets really complicated because our work in that sustainability report did not say one size fits all. It's a per site extreme. You need to do a lot of evaluation to determine what that sustainability standard would be per waterway. So, Mr. Chairman, I hope that answers your questions, and thank you again to the House and the Senate for containing similar language on that transfer of bulk water. We appreciate that.
And just to clarify, Commissioner Meyer, on the Senate language on R65, Section 89 and Section 90, the DNR would oppose. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, yes. And you can look into our letter. I don't want to belabor those issues, but transferring permits, we transfer 99.9% of our permits right now, so it's really not an issue. Section 90, determining it would make us perform a I'm talking about land values. Before a management plan for appropriate water is prepared, the commissioner must provide estimates of the impact on land values in the affected area. We don't have that kind of expertise, right? So maybe it should be the U of M extension or something like that. There's some general information that shows the value of irrigated land versus non-irrigated land. But again, going back to ensuring that we have water for generations to come is where we go on our permitting decisions, making sure that we have that available. And then also Section 91 on the Senate side would prohibit the DNR from disseminating information related to timing, location. Actually, that's all we could say. We wouldn't be able to share any other information with the groundwater management area with the public, except for the timing, location, and agendas of the meeting, but it limits our public information related to groundwater management areas to direct factual responses to the public and media inquiries, which there's a lot of public information we need to share and people need to understand about water management and the importance of that resource, and prohibiting us from providing that information to people is just, in this day and age, extremely problematic. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Meyer, back on Section 85 on the House side, on the public meeting, I think when we had conversation about this in our committee, the reference point on the budget was assuming a in-person public meeting, and we discussed about, you know, we're Zooming a meeting right now, and the costs are different than if we had an in-person public meeting. Has the department looked at, you know, the potential differences in cost from a base assumption of an in-person meeting versus a hybrid or virtual meetings?
Mr. Chairman, again, Bob Meyer, DNR, thank you for bringing that up. We are looking at that. I think one thing that would be good to work with the legislature on that issue of public meeting is the definition of public meeting. It doesn't say it can be a virtual meeting, right? There is really no definition of public meeting, but in our traditional thinking, a public meeting is what we would be doing at the legislature in a conference committee room, right? And we have statutes that require us to have public meetings, for example, on sunfish regulations. Our quality bluegill or quality sunfish initiative that we went through this past summer says we have to have a public meeting in the county where that lake would change would take place. Literally, we had to go through and schedule meetings during COVID in parking lots that were socially distanced and limited amount of people. People could come and go. So that piece is there, Mr. Chairman, about could we do a public meeting via Zoom? But I think we need to clarify what a public meeting is to make sure that that would be legal. And that would, of course, bring the cost down. In working with our staff and our leadership in Ecological Waters and Lands and Minerals Division, they think perhaps if we would change that 216,000 gallons per day to 100 million gallons a year, It would alleviate some of the classes of more common permits that we would be looking at that would be pulled into this conversation. So, Mr. Chairman, we're willing and ready to work with you on this. I will work with staff, Ms. Taylor and others on that, the language about public meeting. Perhaps that might be something we may be able to address yet this year, or for sure we'll need to come back next year and clarify what. I mean, all it is would be saying that a public meeting would include a virtual option or something like that. So, and that would change that cost on that proposal. So, but I do want to say thank you for including funding for those public meetings in your bill as well. So it's not like it would be an unfunded mandate. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, if we could reduce that funding and provide funding for CWD, I think that there would be happiness and joy. You know, the COVID response, we're in a transformative event, a pandemic that has changed the world. And if we only open our eyes and see that it's happened, and that means doing things differently. We have had to do things just like businesses and families around the state doing things differently. And if our statutes need to adjust to make sure that we've got more participation, I think we need to look at that. And here was an opportunity. That's why we're proceeding with this meeting. That we work for Minnesotans. It's not just whether or not we understand. I think it's our responsibility to help Minnesotans understand the issues and the responsibilities and the challenges we face. And so we appreciate that, because what we just went through is an example of problem solving that could be done in the open. And it's disappointing that you know, our Senate colleagues have vanished again. This is the third time, and then one meeting where only Senator Ingebrigtsen showed up. So, but it is part of the record. Maybe they're watching. If they are, I want to say hello and wish you were here. If they're going to watch it later, I think valuable information. Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm hoping that we could spend a little bit of time talking about another threat to our state and our ecosystems, and that's emerald ash borer. You know, I'm old enough to remember the scourge of Dutch elm disease and how awful that was. And we have a similar, if not worse, challenge with emerald ash borer. So again, I'm hoping I might burden Ms. Taylor first, and then maybe we can talk about some of the details around where we are with emerald ash borer and what needs to be done.
Perhaps it's Mr. Hagemeyer if it's financial. So Ms. Taylor is smiling. So Mr. Hagemeyer.
Mr. Chair, you're going to have to give me a minute to find it on the tracking sheet here. Let me pull this up. If you have the Joint Health Senate tracking sheet, if you go to, it'd be on page number 2 of the tracking sheet, you'll see there the appropriations we have. On line 110, there's tree planting for carbon capture, which I know isn't directly for that, but part of the forestry response. And then sorry, I'm not seeing it as the second.
113, ash tree
management. There you go, Mr. Chair. Thank you. My eyesight's not great on the yellow background this morning. Yes, line 113, you'll see ash tree management. The House provided some general fund dollars that goes out to communities. It'd be $750,000 the first year and then $1 million each year thereafter.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Hagemeyer, thank you. Sorry to put you on the spot now, too. And those are for grants to local units of government, is that correct? To help identify and convert stands to more diverse climate-adapted species and also to remove?
Mr. Hagemeyer, or Ms. Taylor?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morrison, yes, I think the grants could be used. They are used for either removal of trees, ash trees currently, or and or the addition of other climate adapted species or diverse species to replace them.
Commissioner Stroman or Commissioner Meyer, any thoughts from to Representative Morrison's question?
Mr. Chairman, I think Commissioner Stroman's still in and out a little bit, and I'll just provide a little bit of comment and background. We appreciate the position in the House bill. As we know, emerald ash borer was discovered in 2009 in St. Paul, a year later in Minneapolis and in southeastern Minnesota. EAB continues to spread, and it was discovered in Greater Duluth in 2016. Our forests are home to an estimated 1 billion ash trees. Many of these trees are in nearly pure stands of black ash growing in wet areas. Once EAB has killed these trees, we're concerned that the wet forest habitat may change over to grass, cattails, and shrubs, threatening the plants and animals that rely on black ash and forest habitats. We also have over 60% of the trees in some communities of being ash, and EAB will continue to strain city budgets as more and more communities are challenged with removing numbers of trees killed by EAB. So it is important for us to provide that resource for communities to deal with the removal and then reforestation of other species. And Mr. Chair, if I may just quickly show a map of where we're at, if you're okay with that.
Proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, actually this is a Minnesota Department of Agriculture map that you can find on their website, but it does show currently the red outlines are our quarantine outer boundaries. So all of southeastern Minnesota into the metropolitan area and all over into St. Cloud. You can see there's some infestations over in southwestern Minnesota as well, and also Duluth. But up in this area of the state where my cursor is circling the arrowhead, the ash resources is predominantly, the tree species are predominantly ash. So we are really concerned about this infestation in Duluth and if it moves forward, what that would mean to the rest of that the forest resources in those areas. Mr. Chairman, it's critical for us to get ahead of this game. Years ago, we prohibited the movement of firewood, which was a dramatic thing for a lot of our customers coming into parks. People would like to have, I'll call it the eternal fire going. They would bring a lot of firewood with them and just, which is fun. People like to do that, be outside and just sit by the fire, right? But that moved a lot of wood around the state. So we prohibited that movement. We've gone to certified wood, making sure you buy your tree, your wood local, things of that nature to reduce the threat of the pest. So again, that's a little bit of background information. It's critical to stay ahead of this game and to do what we can. So we appreciate the resources and the interest that you are throwing at this problem. And I should say we work very closely with the Department of Agriculture on this issue as well. So it's important to understand that they're a part of our response with us. So we appreciate their work and support. So,
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, commissioners. Thanks. I appreciate seeing that map, seeing Duluth, and then that beautiful, vast northeastern part of our state with a billion ash trees in our state. Wow. And the thought of that being decimated is very frightening. So again, I have to go back to, if we don't get this done, what are the potential implications for containing the spread of emerald ash borer? In addition, I appreciate that you mentioned the strain on city budgets. You know, small municipalities don't have the resources to, it's a big job to get rid of this wood and then to reforest. They need help from the state.
Commissioner Stroman or Commissioner Meyer?
Mr. Chair, Sarah Stroman with the Department of Natural Resources. And thank you, Representative Morrison, for raising the question and this really important issue. I think particularly as, you know, we've been talking about the need to plant more trees, right? This is a significant, a potential for a significant backstop in the loss of trees. And it is a significant expense. I mean, we're doing at the state level that proactive response to actually manage some of those ash forests and plant with other species so we don't lose the forest cover ultimately, which, you know, again, would be counter to our climate goals. And one thing I'll point out for communities, not only is it, you know, a cost for the communities themselves, but this is a place where, you know, that hits low-income Minnesotans disproportionately when they, you know, it is not inexpensive to either treat the ash or to remove the ash. And so, you know, this is a place where those areas that have a higher low-income population, it's difficult, right, for them to afford the treatment or the removal. And so having some assistance so that we can make sure, one, that those communities can remain forested with some kind of removal and reforestation effort, but also, as Assistant Commissioner Meyer said, so that we can limit the spread to other places is really important.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for highlighting that this is truly a statewide problem. And, you know, again, referencing the fact that this is particularly devastating on lower income communities, the implications for climate change if we lose that many trees and the cost. So there's this recurrent theme in this committee of prevention is always better. So we have to stay on top of this and get ahead of it. So again, my plea to our Senate counterparts at the Minnesota.
Thank you. Commissioner Meyer, if you could put that map up again, I just wanted to, and then Representative Fisher. Representative Fisher, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And yes, the map would be good to see again. My question is, when we're looking at the sections up in Northeast Minnesota there, it appears that's also, would that also be encompassing a large area of the Boundary Waters wilderness area?
Commissioner Meyer.
Well, I can't see my mute button when I have the map up, so I apologize. Yes, that would contain the Boundary Waters canoe area where we would have significant issues about management and being able to get in there and actually take trees down because of the wilderness area. And that would present some real concerns to the biological diversity in the Boundary Waters canoe area. As we saw with the blowdown previously years ago, decades ago now, it changed the way things were in there. We can't get in there with commercial harvesting equipment. We just let it go naturally, right? And that would be devastating to that resource. Mr. Chairman, if I may just touch on a couple other things related to this, the LIDAR proposal related in your bill, funding our initiative to use forest managed investment account dollars to use LIDAR, which is laser imaging that we've used for elevations. We can use that data now to inventory our forests, and it can actually accelerate the knowledge that we have within our forestry base of telling us what our canopies are, what our forest inventory is, and helping provide us information on how to deal with EAB as well, not only with our entire forest management. So we appreciate that piece there. And as we talk about reforesting, the work of our Bedora Nursery and the support of that facility is greatly appreciated with Representative Lippert's climate change. It was a governor's initiative as well, but you supported and actually accelerated with the funding in the bill to do those issues as well, to produce more seedlings, to get them planted on private property to increase our forest canopy. It's a climate change piece, but also providing, making sure that we're growing the resources to replace the emerald ash borer in certain parts of the state as well is going to be critically important.
Mr. Stroman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to add just 2 points. One is just to give you a scale of the financial implications here. In the early 1980s, we've talked about when the Dutch elm disease hit, the state funded removal of Dutch elm disease, and it was to the tune of $290 million to combat that. And that was to take care of 140 million elm trees. As Assistant Commissioner Meyer said, Emerald Ash Borer could potentially affect more than a billion trees. So if you think of the scale of what we spent on Dutch elm, that's, you know, quite frightening when you think about what we're looking at for Emerald Ash Borer. And then the other thing I just wanted to say in response to Representative Morrison's comment about prevention, you know, when we first came and presented our governor's budget, one of those kind of pillars of the governor's budget was around proactively managing our natural resources. And so that is really one of our strategic priorities in the way that we are hoping to be able to address Minnesota's natural resource management, particularly in the face of changing environments. We want to be ahead of the game. We want to be proactive. We want to prevent issues where we can, one, because it's much less expensive, but two, as Assistant Commissioner Meyer was referring to Aldo Leopold and the, you know, keeping all of the pieces, it's much easier to manage or to put together the puzzle if you still have all the pieces. When you lose one, it's much more difficult. So I did just want to highlight that proactive management is within our strategic priorities and is within the framework of the governor's budget.
Great. Commissioner Meyer, if you could just pop that map up one more time, and I've got a question on that. And I don't know if you have a map on CWD too, but I'm not going to task you with putting them both up at the same time. It appears when we look at this map, you know, I often hear with CWD that it's just coming over from Wisconsin. And the best way to maybe look at when we deal with invasive pests is an invasion, like you see a front that moves through the landscape. And so when you look at Emerald Ash Borer, it seems like we have a front that's moving through the landscape in southeastern Minnesota and the metro area and in Duluth Superior area that you have movement, but it also looks like you've got parachute drops elsewhere in the landscape that are not connected, and that indicates people are moving it. It's not moving. I think the ash borer moves very short distances annually, so people are the vector. And when you see this, you see that front moving in and spread out, like in the metro area, coffee being spilt on the table and spreading out. If we look at the CWD map, there hasn't been a front. It's been parachute drops of infestations around the state. You don't see a front moving along. You see beachheads being established that are not connected with each other. And I don't know if you have that map, but I'm going off of memory there. And I think that indicates the need for the actions that we are taking. And just as when we're dealing with EAB, the actions that we're taking there, because we have to arrest the pest as it's moving through. Commissioner Meyer, I think you're searching for the technology there. I don't know if you've got it or not. But maybe Commissioner Stroman, is that kind of your understanding of the maps as well?
Yes, I think it would be. I haven't actually put those maps side by side, but I'm picturing them as you're describing them, and I can see that Assistant Commissioner Meyer is looking for that map. So if he's not able to find it today, it's certainly something we can provide for the committee.
We'll give him a moment. Part two. Well, he's working on to make sure we thank all of the staff involved that make these committees work. It's very helpful, and we know it's taking time. So, Commissioner Meyer, the CWD map.
Mr. Chairman, members, you can find this map on our website. And what this is showing here is it shows the southeast zone, our new six or a new zone that we created in just south in Dakota County there last year, and the deer. These are actually samples that we've come in that are positive. I believe these squares are positives that are there. And then it shows in this one, the Brainerd area. I was trying to find that new map, and I will share it with you once we end here today. That shows the new Beltrami infestation, which is right up in this area. So it is very alarming to see we went from here all the way up to here, as I described earlier, in the matter of just a year. And this discovery in the Bemidji area, Beltrami County, will involve the sampling and surveillance of a lot more animals. And if we define that, or if we find that disease in the wild, it will put deer harvesting management and the importance of that in light with what we're doing in southeastern Minnesota, Mr. Chairman, depending on the infestation rate and things. We're very concerned about what we're going to find there. But our surveillance will start. And as we talked about in committee, we estimate it's going to cost us about $2.8 million this coming hunting season to detect or to continue our surveillance with our work. And then also that would include some population management in the southeastern part of the state and other areas after the seasons would close if we need to do that per our response plan as well. I will get that map to you, Mr. Chairman, but this shows our situation as of last year. But it's rapidly changing, as we know.
Thank you, Commissioner Meyer and Commissioner Stroman. We can always learn new things, and that's the value of having these open public meetings. Again, I want to express my regret that our Senate colleagues did not stick around to participate. I think there was valuable information provided. But that's the world we're in right now. I remain hopeful that we would be able to achieve compromise, but we will not, the House does not support giving in on the clean car regulation delay. That air quality is too important for that, and putting everything contingent on that is a great risk. It's a great risk. So, when the House has the gavel, we will continue to meet whether the Senate shows up or not. We are paid by the people to be here and to participate. We take that responsibility seriously and will continue to do so. So thank you, members. We are adjourned.